Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 85 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. As far as crusade history goes, most of them are pretty straightforward. European Christians head to the Holy Land to take it from the Muslims currently living there. But while the so-called Fourth Crusade started out that way, it really went off the rails with the Crusader army sacking and burning Constantinople instead. This week, Peter Konieczny from Medievalist.net got me to read a first-hand account of the Fourth Crusade that's known as the Conquest of Constantinople, written by a knight named Robert of Cléry. Here's our conversation about this chronicle and its account of this strange turn of events. Welcome, Peter, to talk about the conquest of Constantinople. Good to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having you here in the new studio.
New studio. Peter is making a reference to the fact that I've just moved. And yeah, we're sitting on the floor. It's very classy. Okay, so let's get to work, Peter. The conquest of Constantinople. Tell us a little bit about this book club that you and I started reading this book together. What is this book about?
First thing, it's a book. So for some reason, I had two copies of this translation of The Conquest of Constantinople. It's an account by Robert of Cléry of the Fourth Crusade. And yeah, I had two translations. And I remember I had read this book maybe like 25 years ago. And I thought, I had very good memories of it. So it's a good crusader account, crusaders against Byzantium, things like that. So I said, we have to read this. So I don't think I was impressed the second time around it, but, it is basically a kind of soldier's view of the events of 1203 and 1204, crusaders deciding to go, the crusade is launched. They arrive in Venice, they sail in, they wind up going to the capital of the Byzantine Empire. Lots of fighting, a little bit of what happens on the end. So, but, Robert, he's a French knight. He's from Picardy. You get the feeling that he is he's not lowest of the low in the army. He's not the higher ups. So you get a certain viewpoint. There are a couple of other accounts, main accounts of the crusade. One is by Godfrey of Villardun, and he's kind of one of the crusade leaders. You also have a Byzantine account of the history of that era, so we have that point of view, but his is this a bit of more, Brent level.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, but let's back it up a little bit. This is the Fourth Crusade. How did they end up sacking Constantinople? Because crusades were supposed to be against Muslims in the Holy Land in order to reclaim Jerusalem. How does this happen? What are they doing in Constantinople?
Okay, so let's go through the history. So basically, you have various crusades, attempts, they're supposed to take back Jerusalem. In this case, there's this kind of call for a crusade in Europe. Gets a lot of French knights as well as others involved. And they say, all right, they want to attack Egypt because it's really rich. So that becomes a running theme in the 13th century, by the way. So, but they decide that they're going to need transportation. They want, and the various crusade leaders make a deal with Venice. And this is they could have made a deal with Genoa or another city to help them move the troops over. But they make this kind of deal that we're going to have 100,000 men. You're going to have to, we're all going to arrive a little bit after Easter of 1202, and you will sail us. You'll have a fleet ready, and we're going to pay you such and such an amount. When the crusaders start arriving, their expectations seem to be of how many people would arrive is nowhere near that. So the Doge, the Venetian Doge, kind of makes a new deal with them. All right, you can't pay us the money that you owe us. We're going to have to take a little bit of a diversion. So he says, well, we'll sail. We're going to go first to Zara, this kind of port on the Adriatic, who's been bothering him, being rebellious and all sorts. You have to take that city back, which they do. And then while they're waiting there over the winter, they come up, we need a new idea of how we're going to get money. So the crusaders are always running low on money. So, but one of them knows a guy who was son of a Byzantine emperor, and through various politics, his father gets overthrown and blinded. He has to flee to, I believe, Hungary. He's kind of just sitting there, and they say, well, if we will take you, Alexius, back to Constantinople, and you can retake the city, and then you will pay us. You'll pay us money, and convert the city to Catholicism from Orthodox, and just, you know, you will head us over. So Alexius, you know, obviously agrees, and they sail on to Constantinople. So, and that brings them there.
Yeah, so I think the agreement that they make with the Venetians is something like 100,000 marks. And when they show up, they only have 50,000. And they only have about 50,000 people as well. And the Venetians are like, we've been working on this for a year and a half. We're losing a lot of money. They scrape together some more, but they're still, yeah, they're still short like 36,000 marks. And it's actually kind of interesting in this account. They say, well, Constantinople is really rich. If we could find a reason to go and get some of their money, that would be good. And that's when someone says, well, you know, I have an idea. We need to put someone else back on. Is it a throne when it's an emperor? I don't know. We're going to put someone else back in charge, and that'll be good. And they talk it over with the bishops, and the bishops are like, this is pretty holy. You know, close enough. We're on a crusade. We can do this. So yeah, they go and they sack Constantinople.
Now, there are some things, like there was one crusader leader that like disagrees with this. Like one thing you get in Robert's account is that, yeah, not everyone agrees. Like, you know, there's doubts, kind of comes up again and again in his account that it's never like a unified idea. So like someone like, no, this is a terrible idea to go to Constantinople. I'm supposed to go fight like Muslims. So like he like runs off in a huff. And like, you know, when they attack Zara, like they get excommunicated. So at that time, because Zara was under papal protection. So it's interesting that like the Doge gets a very nice treatment by Robert, like the good Doge. You just, you know, like I understand his problems and stuff like that. Like modern historians tend to be like, oh, the Doge planned this all out. You know, he was like a conniving guy and he figured it all out. But if you hear from Robert, it's like everyone's, it's just almost accidental this happens. Like, you know, we have to do the best we can. We have to go to Constantinople. Just the way the fortune are.
They show up and they're like thousands and thousands of marks short. And they're like, Robert says, the Doge was so nice. He still fed everybody. He still made sure we all had food and drink. He's still a good host, even though we're not paying him enough. But yeah, even the way he has him like couch the terms in which he uses to say that they need to go to Zara. He's saying that, you know, these people have vexed us, but you know, it's a pretty nice place and they've got lots of supplies. So let's head over there. And then they get there and he's like, I don't like these people. We should attack them, even though they'll be excommunicated, which they are. But then they're forgiven pretty soon afterwards, right?
Yeah, yeah. Everyone seems to be on board more or less by the time they get to Constantinople of this action. You know, Constantinople, you know, they're Eastern Orthodox religion, so there's always lingering tension with Catholicism. There's a real prejudice against Greeks, as Robert calls them. And so you see that in his account. Like, there's this little story he relates about an emperor named Manuel, who was actually like, this is Manuel's reign, like, ended like 30 years earlier. So, but Manuel, you know, him and the Franks were getting along nicely. The Greeks didn't like the Franks. And Manuel, you know, he made like an idea where like the Franks and the Greeks would do battle and the Greeks run away. So that proves that the Franks are just better. So you get that like foreshadowing, I think, like because he's trying to kind of portray the Greeks, the like people of Byzantium, as kind of, you know, duplicitous and weak and not very warlike, you know, so, which is a real big trend in like, you know, Western European literature and chronicles and stuff like that. So,
yeah, especially when you're looking back on a situation in which you sacked Constantinople pretty much unprovoked. And this is a good moment to say that when we talked about Byzantium Unbound with Anthony Caldelis, we were talking about this kind of stuff. So you can go back to that episode and listen to that, and then you can listen to his podcast, Byzantium and Friends, where they really talk about that and some of this prejudice between what they call the Latins and the Greeks. This is what the Europeans call the difference. Okay, so they show up to Constantinople. It's huge. They're looking at it and going, wow, this place is amazing. And Robert says, you know, the people of Constantinople are looking down on the fleet and going, wow, those guys are amazing. So what happens? The emperor at first says, hey guys, like, what's up? Can I give you some money so you can go on your crusade? And they basically say, no, we're here to replace you. And that's when things go south. So what happens next?
Yeah, yeah. So you've got at first they try and send like this new young emperor says, hey, I'm the emperor. Don't you know me? And they said, no, we don't have no idea who you are. And we're going to fight you. And it looks like there's going to be a big battle outside the city walls. And this is a really interesting part. It's almost like Robert writes kind of extensively as kind of like a crusader's different like armies of the crusader force, like are trying to, you know, get their cavalry into position to charge and attack, and are all kind of one-upping each other to try and get towards the Byzantine line. And then they're just about to do this big battle, and they keep, and then the Byzantines just, you know, retreat back into the city. So, and like, oh, the Christians are like, oh, we couldn't fight them and stuff like that. But then, like, the next day, the Byzantine emperor flees. And so the new Byzantine emperor gets installed. So, like, that's kind of anticlimactic at that point. So, and it seems like things are going to go rosy at that point. Like, they've done their job. The Byzantine emperor is promising them everything. Of course, he needs to take back some other cities. So the Crusaders are winding up, you know, going to city after city, which I think kind of surrender pretty quickly. And but then things go in trouble again.
Yeah, so the new emperor, the young man, is saying, well, I'll pay you, but first you have to conquer these cities for me. So they start conquering those cities. And meanwhile, his counselor tells him, don't pay the Christians or don't pay the Europeans because you've already given them a lot. You don't need to give them any more. And then it gets worse.
Yeah, like, now, Robert, because he's not really privy to what's going on in the high levels, he's got, like, this kind of vague accounts of, like, being duplicitous and stuff like that. And he's kind of going along for a ride. So he doesn't know what's going on, but, you know, he winds up like, oh, no, we have to fight them again. Because, the, you know, the Crusader's like, no, we're going to attack you and overthrow you. And we wind up having this kind of longer siege, which, by this time, it's like winter has arrived in the area, so like they really can't do a naval attack. So it's a lot of time is kind of spent just watching the Byzantines reinforce the city walls. Byzantines try and send like fireboats to like burn down the Crusader fleet, which don't work. But it all kind of comes along to the, until the Crusaders can launch an attack. And Constantinople is such a big city with such large walls that they have a lot of places they can attack. And so they make two attempts.
They split their forces and they try to attack by land and by sea, right?
Yes, yes. And so we have their first attack where I believe it's like basically they try. The seas are fairly rough. So like the Crusaders aren't able to capture any, like get their forces on top of the towers. Like they talk about like the siege machines sending like huge stones that smash the Crusader like siege weaponry. Crusader fleet winds up like fleeing with the Byzantines showing their backsides to the Crusaders as they go, and like, and it's one really interesting part is that Crusaders get back to their camp and it's like half of them are really despondent, like, oh, you know, we did the wrong thing, we should have never attacked, this is the God telling us that, you know, maybe we should just go, you know, we've lost. And at a point it's like it's the clergy, the bishops that are there that like they say, no, you're doing the right thing. This person has betrayed us. Byzantines are treacherous. You know, this, we have to try it again. So they won for a second try.
Yeah, and it's at this point, I think, where they have actually got, like, the kitchen boys and the horse boys even all armored up in whatever they can find. They put saddles on them. So, yeah, but they have the kitchen boys and the horse boys that are dressed up as well. And for some reason, this makes the Byzantines uneasy, probably because they're like, well, why are they sending these boys at us when they have other people? So, yeah, so they're attacking again by land and by sea, right? What happens next?
Yeah, we've got, so this is like the, I would say if you read this book, this is probably the best part where Robert, like, there are various attacks. Robert is in the thick of this. Like, it gets to a point where they're talking about, like, where Robert and his lord, They see along the walls, like they're on a ship, and they see along the walls a small sally port that had been closed off. But they figure we can probably break that down. Like, and so they kind of land on this little speck of land in between the wall and the sea. And Robert's, the way Robert's like saying it, it's like there's like a dozen of us there. We've got like shields protecting us because they're throwing stones and arrows at us, and I don't know how we're going to make it. Like, you know, but we're trying to break down this door with like axes and knives and swords. So, you know, almost imagine that was like to me like the best little scene. They finally break enough down that they could crawl a person into it. But unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of Byzantines on the other side.
Yeah, I think it says something like, it appears as if the whole world was on the other side of it.
And it seems so dangerous. But so Robert is there and his brother is there and his name's Alamus. And he's a cleric. He's not a warrior. He's not a knight. But Alamus is like, no, I'm going to do it. And he wants to be the first person in. And you have a great little scene where Robert is like, Robert is trying to keep him from, going in. He's pulling at his feet. But Alamus kind of gets in there. And for some reason, he scares off the Byzantines and says, more people can come in. And so this little band gets into the tower and is able to capture this tower.
And meanwhile, there's another spot where a ship is kind of bashing up against the tower. And one of the people jumps off the ship and is trying to fight his way in and he gets hacked to death. But then someone else gets to jump off the ship and starts to fight his way into the tower. Yeah, this part is the most exciting part of the whole book, for sure.
They're eventually able to, Robert and Claire and Alamus and their kind of unit are able to open up a gate that's nearby. And that allows a bunch of other Crusader forces to kind of get in through the landway, and the Byzantines have to retreat at this point. So the Crusaders are inside the city, but they're kind of because it's such a big area, the actual city is still somewhat far off. The Crusaders are camped out there that night, and they're going to prepare for another battle. Guys, do you think there'll be another battle that night?
But no, the new emperor runs away, doesn't he?
That's right. What Robert doesn't say is that there's also a big fire that happens that burns around a third of the city at this time. But in the middle of the night, the emperor has fled. And by this time, there's a new emperor, by the way. We should have mentioned that. The one that the Crusaders installed had been killed.
Yeah, I've been murdered by the evil counselor, and now the evil counselor was the emperor. He does mention the fire. The Venetians are like, so how was your day, Crusaders? Because we burned down a third of the city, and Crusaders are like, oh, we haven't been that successful. So they do mention it a little bit. But yeah, the evil counselor, who's now the emperor, now takes off.
Yes, he flees. They elect another emperor who promptly flees as well, within a few hours. And so the next morning, the Crusaders who are out just outside the city had learned that everyone who's rich is gone. It's just the poor people that left. Let's go in. And they already start figuring out how to divvy up the city. And they have plans. Everyone has plans. We're all going to do this, nicely. And it doesn't go well.
Yeah, they're trying to decide who is going to be on the council to elect the new emperor. And other times they're trying to decide who gets to decide what goes to whom, who the treasure goes to. And there's a lot of mistrust and a lot of democratic type voting where, you get people in groups of 20. It seems to often be groups of 20 that decide on things, but you want to have the right person on that council because, they're going to root for you. And they're trying to make it as quote unquote fair as possible by making it more random, but really everything falls into the hands of the rich as usual.
Yeah, Robert is not really aware, he doesn't know what's happening behind the scenes. So a lot of what he's seeing is this, what's happening out in public, right? There's, when they install a crusader as the emperor, he's there to watch it, right? So he's able to tell us. But all the kind of scenes, any kind of scenes by it, he's just maybe hearing it as third hand almost. So, but, he is very upset at one point. So this thing turns terrible, but he's upset because he doesn't get as much money as he's hoping for. The low and poor knights of the crusade aren't getting their deservedly share of it.
Yeah, he mentions a couple of times that by the time the rich are done with the treasure, all that's left is these silver ewers that the women would take to the baths. And I'm thinking, you're still getting pure silver, man. That's pretty cool. But they're like, yeah, we didn't get any of the gold or jewels or anything.
Yeah, and he has no compunction or remorse for the civilians that are left in a city. They almost do not exist for, so they're basically looting everything, trying to figure out who's in charge. And everyone wants a little piece of the Byzantine Empire. So it's this lord is named the Lord of the Straits of St. George, and he will go over and take that little spot. And this one will take this other city, and this one. And you're wondering, because aren't these the one who becomes the emperor at first, he's the Count of Flanders. And like, that's not, you know, lunch money, you know, it's a good little place, but like, man, there's like no, like none of them have like any care about going back. It's like, this is so wealthy that we have to come here and stay. So it's just, you know, almost pure greed.
Yeah. At the end, the final or almost final, there are so many emperors in this, man. This is like the romance of the three kingdoms. But one of the last emperors, yeah, everyone comes up to him and says, okay, if I can conquer this part of the empire, can I have it? And he's like, yeah, sure, whatever.
There's this wonderful part, like, oh, well, not wonderful, but there's this last emperor, one of these emperors that gets driven out, that evil counselor. They call him Murzuphilus in the text. And like, he's Alexius V. That's like, they have him, like, he gets captured. Now, what Robert doesn't say, because Robert's, you know, like, oh, one of our knights, you know, found him along, you know, with some women, and he captures them and he brings them back. In fact, he went to one of the other emperors that had fled, the first one that fled. He went there to seek protection, and he got blinded for it and was abandoned. So basically he was abandoned, and then the Crusaders came along. They captured him, and they kind of put him on trial for treachery against the emperor. And they decided, like, we're going to give him high justice, which is...
Yeah, pretty gruesome.
Which is, they get him to climb up one of the columns in the city, and they throw him off. So,
yeah, like a hermit's column or something, and they climb up the stairs and they throw him off, and yeah, that's the end of him.
Doesn't it remind you of when we were talking, like, the Murder of Charles the Good book? The same, like, you know, being tossed off a high place seems to be, you know, an interesting way to go, so.
Yeah, and they were trying to decide how to murder him or how to give him justice, quote-unquote justice. Because it's all very subjective. And I think that's one thing that you really need to give Robert credit for, is you get to see how much of this is subjective, right? So it's like, how do we decide from one moment to another what is the right thing to do? And it doesn't always or even often follow what you would expect kind of a moral code to be.
The account kind of, the last few pages of the account gets kind of rushed. There's a lot of events that happen over several years that get put in a couple pages. That's because Robert by this time has gone home. I think one of his lords gets killed, and they think his unit returns back to Picardy. So we wind up the first Latin emperor, this Baldwin, he winds up getting killed in a battle with the Cumans fairly soon after. His brother becomes emperor, and he dies like, yeah, although it sounds like he dies like right away. It's actually several years later. So, but you wind up with this kind of like city under like Crusader control, and this very much a chaotic region.
Yeah, it's very much, and this is again something that I was talking with Anthony about a few months ago. It's very much, it gives you the impression that this is occupied territory, and it's really just awful for the people who are living there. And it's just, yeah, it's being divided up by jackals. It's really, it's awful. And it's not what you would expect necessarily from an account of something that's supposed to be a crusade, you know?
Yeah, like in Robert's mind, everything that happened is foretold by certain prophecies that seem to have been like discovered like while they're in Constantinople. Like, this is God's will, I guess, in his mind. And he doesn't see anything bad about it. But, you know, it's like, well, you know, we kind of found this place. And like, oh, it's such a rich city. And it's ours now. And there's like one real interesting little part where like one of the locals, I think it's a Cuman leader, goes up to one of the, you know, French knights and say, well, you know, why are you here? Like, why did you come all the way out here and to take this? And he responds with like the legend of Troy. And it's like, oh, you know, this, you know, we were the, like, our ancestors were the Trojans that were, you know, thrown out of, had to flee this region. And now we're coming back to take it because it's rightfully ours. So you can see how, it's one of those things where I said, oh, you know, your little knowledge of history, which is not true, by the way. Like, the French are not the Trojans. Like, but everyone in Europe claims that, like, we are from the Trojans.
Well, I just wanted to clarify the thing I said about the Crusades. I don't want to imply that the Crusades were great, but often people write about the Crusades like they're black and white and, you know, a good thing from the writer's perspective. But yeah, it's wobbly, the reasons that they are there. You know, it kind of changes from one reason to another, and they have different justifications for it as time goes on. And I don't know, it's hard to say if Robert was trying to illustrate that. Probably not, especially when you consider that he's dictating it, right? So it's not something that he's going back and maybe necessarily editing. He might have it read back to him and he might, you know, be dictating it again. But I think when you kind of are dictating a story like end to end, you have things like little wobbles about the reasons about why you're there, especially when it's such a long account. It must have taken a while to get it down.
Yeah, I think you get the impression that Robert's, you know, a naive kind of guy. He's there along for the ride. Like, he doesn't have any decision making in all this. Like, basically, he's there and he's concerned about his brother, having his brother getting a share of the spoils. But, like, you don't see from him, like, any kind of, like, hey, or, you know, are we doing this the right way? Like, or is this morally right? Like, there are rumors about that. You never get that, like, Robert's personal view on this matter.
Yeah, he's not terribly introspective. Okay, so there's a couple of things that I like to pull out of this that I thought were really cool. One of the things was that the Venetians have to decide half of them are going to go with the Crusaders and half of them are going to stay behind. And they can't figure out who's going to do it. So they draw lots. But I've never heard of doing it this way before, which is they have these pairs of like wax balls, Lizzie, like one ball of wax, just pure wax, and one ball of wax that has a paper in it. And they give it to the priest. The priest blesses them and he hands them out. And if you have the wrong ball, I think the ball with the paper in it, then you have to go with the Crusaders. But you know, you hear about drawing a short straw. I've never heard about like making a ball of wax as being the way to draw lots. I thought that was pretty cool.
One scene I really liked is when they all leave Venice. They have all the ships ready, and like Robert is like in awe. He's like, I've never seen such a glorious fleet. And I can imagine like probably have hundreds of ships like all like sailing out, you know, and just that kind of left an impression on me. So
yeah, and it's something he probably wouldn't have seen. I mean, you don't see a fleet like that every day, and there's trumpets and drums, and they think it's pretty impressive. And the other part that I thought was really cool was the floating bridges that they built between the ships when they were besieging Constantinople. So they built actual bridges that he said you could ride 3 knights across along these bridges. And they actually built them up and put hides on them to make them repellent to fire. So building these bridges is a way of like bringing troops from one place to the other. They have knights that are jumping into the surf, which is pretty impressive considering they're going to be wearing some armor. And then even ships that would lower kind of a ramp so that the knights could get off of it as well. This is pretty cool technology, as well as a lot of the ships having mangonels as well, which are catapults. So pretty cool stuff as part of the siege in terms of technology for naval warfare.
Oh, yeah. The part of me wishes that he just wrote more and more, because there's so many little details that you don't get in other accounts. Like, this is... Again, like soldier's eye level view of warfare. So you don't get that in Godfrey of Villardun's account. And like even like other kind of crusade accounts are very, sometimes can be very short. And this, you even get a bit of like, you know, camp life and, just living just day to day. So, which is really neat to see.
Yeah. I mean, overall, to me, this is kind of a dry one, except for the section in the middle where they're actually besieging, which I think is more interesting. You know, of the books that you've had me read for the podcast, The Murder of Charles the Good, I think, is higher up, but that's one of your favorite ones. But yeah, it was an interesting read.
Yeah, I think, like, again, like, the first time I read it, I think I went into it, like, I was more of a naive reader as well, so a lot of it, oh, this is a great little tale. And then, like, you kind of realize, like, later on, after reading more and more works and history, like, well, Robert's really wrong about a lot of stuff. So it's like, oh man, just skip over this story that just someone told him. It's nothing. But it's a like a bit of a hit and miss book. I think if you do like warfare, there's a lot of stuff you'll like it. You might want to like kind of skim through the first half of the work.
Yeah, and maybe make a chart of the emperors as they start getting knocked off like bowling pins. All right, Peter, what have you got for us on the website this week?
Well, you know, it's been Halloween, just came and gone for us. So, you know, we had a lot of kind of spooky related stuff. So, you know, we had Adam Alley. He was talking about Jin those kind of demons and devils of the medieval Islamic world. So there was a king of Friday, by the way. I did not know that.
That's,
and we get our ghouls from the medieval Islamic world. We also have an Icelandic ghost story that's where the ghost is very nice, cooks the people a meal. So,
well, I need one of those.
We have Alice Sullivan. She's talking about Vlad III the Tepes, the better known as Dracula. So, we have that, and then Catherine Walton. She writes about, you know, what happened to corpses on the medieval battlefield. None of which is good. So, so she has that. So we have all that kind of stuff this week on this site.
Awesome. Yeah. Everything from corpses to what happens afterwards. All right. Thanks, Peter, for coming on and talking about the conquest of Constantinople and telling us what's on the website. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot.
As I mentioned last week, I've just released something I'm super excited about, the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. It's an online course for people who are creating fictional worlds based in or on the medieval world and who need some visual and audible content to help them describe the medieval world in more detail. So, it's really targeted at novelists, graphic novelists, game designers, television and movie writers, and anyone else who needs some more 3D research. I've got a list of stellar experts lined up, including Ken Modenshine, our swordmaster, Beth Rogers, our food historian, Katrin Kanya, our textile archaeologist, and Tom Timbrell, our blacksmith. They'll be showing you the basics of fighting, feasting, making clothing, and making metal, and you get to watch them do it, giving you the benefit of their expertise, as well as giving you the ability to see and describe or draw their movements. You'll also get access to me for questions about your project, and you'll get an exclusive bibliography for further research. Registration is open now, and class starts November 13th, but I only have a handful of spots left, so if you want a seat in the pilot course, get on it. If you don't make it this time, have no fear, I'll be running this course again in January, but it won't be at such a deep discount. You can find out all the details at medievalmasterclass.thinkific.com. That's medievalmasterclass.thinkific.com. Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for your support. If you love the medieval world, visit our Patreon page to find everything from subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, to our book club, to our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from Constantinople to creepy corpses, follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening. Have yourself a wonderful day.